Codification of tradition is necessarily dependent upon existence of tradition, established adaptive behavior, and secondary representation thereof. The knowledge embodied in such tradition exists as a consequence of evolutionary pressure, so to speak, operating primarily, in the literal sense, at the level of interpersonal action, and is only secondarily, lately, translated up the hierarchy of consciousness to representation. This means that evolution proceeds at least as often, and generally more profoundly, from behavior to representation, episodic and semantic, from adaptive action and mythic portrayal thereof, all true art included, to abstract verbal knowledge, as from representation to behavior. Translation of tradition into law makes verbally abstract what had previously been, at best, encoded in image, makes the morality of the culture and the moral individual conscious for the first time. This act of transformation, culminating in a qualitative shift of cognitive sophistication in the intrapsychic activity of a mythologized culture hero, constitutes the consequence of centuries of abstract adaptive endeavor. The actions of the hero are identified with heavenly attributes by the story to signify the import and intrapsychic locale and source of the revolutionary occurrence. Nietzsche states, "Great men, like great epochs, are explosive material in whom tremendous energy has been accumulated. Their prerequisite has always been, historically and physiologically, that a protracted assembling, accumulating, economizing, and preserving has preceded them, that there has been no explosion for a long time. If the tension in the mass has grown too great, the merest accidental stimulus suffices to call the genius, the deed, the great destiny into the world." The moral presumptions of a society emerge first in procedural form as a consequence of individual exploratory activity, which is the process that generates novel behavioral patterns. These behavioral patterns are then hierarchically structured as a consequence of quasi-Darwinian competition, in accordance with the constraints noted previously: appeal to imagination, self-sustenance, etc. The episodic memory systems map procedure and outcome thereof, and thereby come to contain similar paradigmatic structure, imagistically and then more purely semantically. Over time, the unknown nature thereby comes to be represented mythically as the affectively bivalent Great Mother, simultaneously creative and destructive. The known culture becomes the Great Father, tyrant and wise king, authoritarian and protective personality, adapted to the unknown. The knower, man, becomes the hostile mythic brothers, sons of convention, hero and anti-hero, Christ and Satan, eternal generator and destroyer of history and tradition. Semantic cognition, feeding on narrative, the bridge between the episode and the pure verbal abstraction, derives rules from behavior. Application of the rules alters the environment, including procedural and episodic representations thereof. Thus, the cycle continues. Culture protects the individual against the consequences of his or her vulnerability, at least in its positive aspect, but the price paid for absolute security is freedom and individuality, and therefore creativity. Sacrifice of individual creativity, by choice, eventually deprives life of pleasure, of meaning, but not of anxiety or pain, and therefore renders life unbearable. Civilized or historical Homo sapiens grows up within a structured canon of principles implicitly and explicitly posited and held as absolute by the majority of individuals within his or her civilization. In return for this legacy, which is in fact the sum total of the efforts of mankind over thousands of years, the individual is molded and shaped, and can therefore survive independently. But all this shaping is not purely beneficial. It is an unhappy fact that the intrinsically rewarding, implicitly interesting activities associated with individual heroism often come to pose a threat to the established structure of the group. The Great Father, positive aspect of history, protects man from the terrible mother. He is civilized order, education and wisdom embodied and represented, the abstracted and integrated personification of all those heroes who have come before and left their mark on the cultural behavior of the species. He is ritual model for emulation, good king, wise judge, man of courage, of action, of art, of thought. Insofar as he represents particular specific patterns of action, however, he is the enemy of possibility, of life in the present itself, of the hero, and is therefore necessarily captor of the spirit, embodiment of the tyrant, the bureaucrat. This is history as the terrible father, dead weight of the past, crushing mass of narrow, bigoted, ill-informed opinion and popular prejudice. This is the force that oppresses the good mother, the creative aspect of life itself. The terrible father opposes anything new, anything that threatens his integral structure and absolute dominance. Identification of the well-adapted man with his culture means that as history becomes established in counterposition to the force that nature represents, the creative hero has to battle public opinion, composed when ideological of contemporary slogans, Sluag Germs, Welsh, battle cries of the dead, as well as the forces of the natural unknown. The hero is an enemy of the historically determined structure of values and assumptions because he may have to reorder that structure and not merely add to it or maintain it to deal with what still remains unknown. In that process of reordering, unfortunately, he risks exposing himself and all those well-adapted men who identify with and maintain that culture to the terrible forces of the unknown, to mortal anxiety and dread, to fear of the void, to terror of insanity, physical destruction, and annihilation. These ideas are dramatically presented in Dostoevsky's The Grand Inquisitor in The Brothers Karamazov. Ivan, tormented atheist, tells a story he has invented to his religiously minded younger brother, Alyosha, a novice at the local monastery. Christ returns to earth, to Seville, during the time of the Spanish Inquisition. He came unobserved and moved about silently. But strangely enough, those who saw him recognized him at once. This might perhaps be the best part of my poem if I could explain what made them recognize him. People are drawn to him by an irresistible force. They gather around him, follow him, and soon there is a crowd. He walks among them in silence, a gentle smile of infinite compassion on his lips. The sun of love burns in his heart. Light, understanding, and spiritual power flow from his eyes and set people's hearts vibrating with love for him. He holds his hands out to them, blesses them, and just from touching him or even his clothes comes a healing power. An old man who has been blind from childhood suddenly cries out to him, "Cure me, O Lord, so that I may see you too." And it is as if scales had fallen from his eyes, and the blind man sees him. People weep and kiss the ground on which he walks. Children scatter flowers in his path and cry out to him, "Hosanna! It is he himself." People keep saying, "Who else could it be?" He stops on the steps of the Cathedral of Seville at a moment when a small white coffin is carried into the church by weeping bearers. In it lies a girl of 7, the only daughter of a prominent man. She lies there amidst flowers. He will raise your child from the dead, people shout to the weeping mother. The priest, who has come out of the cathedral to meet the procession, looks perplexed and frowns. But now the mother of the dead child throws herself at his feet, wailing, "If it is truly you, give me back my child," and she stretches out her hands to him. The procession stops. They put the coffin down at his feet. He looks down with compassion. His lips form the words, "Talitha kumi," "Arise, maiden," and the maiden arises. The little girl sits up in her coffin, opens her little eyes, looks around in surprise, and smiles. She holds the white roses that had been placed in her hand when they had laid her in the coffin. There is confusion among the people, shouting and weeping. Just at that moment, the cardinal, the Grand Inquisitor himself, crosses the cathedral square. He is a man of almost 90, tall and erect. His face is drawn, his eyes are sunken, but they still glow as though a spark smoldered in them. Oh, now he is not wearing his magnificent cardinal's robes in which he paraded before the crowds the day before when they were burning the enemies of the Roman Church. No, today he is wearing just the coarse cassock of an ordinary monk. He is followed by his grisly assistants, his slaves, his holy guard. He sees the crowd gathered, stops, and watches from a distance. He sees everything, the placing of the coffin and the girl rising from it. His face darkens. He knits his thick white brows. His eyes flash with an ominous fire. He points his finger and orders his guards to seize him. The Grand Inquisitor's power is so great, and the people are so submissive and tremblingly obedient to him, that they immediately open up a passage for the guards. A death-like silence descends upon the square, and in that silence the guards lay hands on him and lead him away. Then everyone in the crowd, to a man, prostrates himself before the Grand Inquisitor. The old man blesses them in silence and passes on. The guards take their prisoner to an old building of the Holy Inquisition and lock him up there in a dark, narrow, vaulted prison cell. The day declines and is replaced by the stifling black southern night of Seville. The air is fragrant with laurel and lemon. Suddenly, in the complete darkness, the iron gate of the cell opens, and there stands the Grand Inquisitor himself, holding a light in his hand. The old man enters the cell alone, and when he is inside, the door closes behind him. He stops, and for a long time, 1 or even 2 minutes, he looks at him. At last, he sets the light down on the table and says, "You? Is it really you?" Receiving no answer, he continues in great haste, "You need not answer me. Say nothing. I know only too well what you could tell me now. Besides, you have no right to add anything to what you said before. Why did you come here to interfere and make things difficult for us? For you came to interfere. You know it. But shall I tell you what will happen tomorrow? Well, I do not know who you really are, nor do I want to know whether you are really he or just a likeness of him. But no later than tomorrow I shall pronounce you the wickedest of all heretics and sentence you to be burned at the stake. And the very people who today were kissing your feet will tomorrow, at a sign of my hand, hasten to your stake to rake the coals. Don't you know it?" "Oh, yes, I suppose you do," he added, deeply immersed in thought, his eyes fixed for a moment on his prisoner. Despite his tyrannical actions, the Inquisitor feels compelled to justify his actions before Christ. Dostoevsky's Ivan continues, Your great prophet had a vision and told us in an allegory that he had seen all those who were in the first resurrection and that there were 12,000 of them from each tribe. But if there were so many, they must have been gods rather than men. They bore your cross. They endured years and years of hunger in a barren wilderness, living on roots and locusts. And, of course, you can point proudly at these children of freedom, at their freely given love, and at their magnificent suffering for your sake. Remember, though, there were only a few thousand of them, and even these were gods rather than men. But what about the rest? Why should the rest of mankind, the weak ones, suffer because they are unable to stand what the strong ones can? Why is it the fault of a weak soul if it cannot live up to such terrifying gifts? Can it really be true that you came only for the chosen few? If that is so, it is a mystery that we cannot understand. And if it is a mystery, we have the right to preach to man that what matters is not freedom of choice or love, but a mystery that he must worship blindly, even at the expense of his conscience. And that is exactly what we have done. We have corrected your work and have now founded it on miracle, mystery, and authority. And men rejoice at being led like cattle again with the terrible gift of freedom that brought them so much suffering removed from them. Tell me, were we right in preaching and acting as we did? Was it not our love for men that made us resign ourselves to the idea of their impotence and lovingly try to lighten the burden of their responsibility, even allowing their weak nature to sin, but with our permission? Why have you come to interfere with our work? The old priest explains what historical role the institution of the church has played and why, and provides rationale for the necessity of the impending re-crucifixion. And we, who have taken their sins upon us to give them happiness, will stand up and say to you, judge us if you can and if you dare. Know that I am not afraid of you. Know that I too lived in the wilderness, fed upon roots and locusts, that I too blessed the freedom which you bestowed upon men, and that I, too, was prepared to take my place among the strong, chosen ones, aspiring to be counted among them. But I came to my senses and refused to serve a mad cause. I turned away and joined those who were endeavoring to correct your work. I left the proud and turned to the meek for the happiness of the meek. What I have told you will happen, and our kingdom will come. I repeat, tomorrow you will see obedient herds, at the first sign from me, hurry to heap coals on the fire beneath the stake at which I shall have you burned, because by coming here you have made our task more difficult. For if anyone has ever deserved our fire, it is you, and I shall have you burned tomorrow. Dixie. The story takes an unexpected twist just prior to its conclusion, a twist that illustrates Dostoevsky's genius and his capacity to leap beyond the ideologically and easily obvious. Ivan says, "The Grand Inquisitor falls silent and waits for some time for the prisoner to answer. The prisoner's silence has weighed on him. He has watched him. He listened to him intently, looking gently into his eyes and apparently unwilling to speak. The old man longs for him to say something, however painful and terrifying. But instead, he suddenly goes over to the old man and kisses him gently on his old, bloodless lips. And that is his only answer. The old man is startled and shudders. The corners of his lips seem to quiver slightly. He walks to the door, opens it, and says to him, 'Go now, and do not come back, ever. You must never, never come again. And he lets the prisoner out into the dark streets of the city. The prisoner leaves. As William James said, the community stagnates without the impulse of the individual. The impulse dies away without the sympathy of the community. The myths of a culture are its central stories. These stories provide a dramatic record of the historically predicated transformation of human intent and appear to exist as the episodic / semantic embodiment of history's cumulative effect on action. The mythical narratives that accompany retention of historically determined behavior constitute non-empirical episodic representation of that behavior and its method of establishment. Myth is purpose, coded in episodic memory. Mythic truth is information derived from past experience, derived from past observation of behavior, relevant from the perspective of fundamental motivation and affect. Myth simultaneously provides a record of historical essential in terms of behavior and programs those historical essentials. Narrative provides semantic description of action in image, back translatable into imaginary episodic events capable of eliciting imitative behavior. Mythic narrative offers dramatic presentation of morality, which is the study of what should be. Such narrative concerns itself with the meaning of the past, with the implications of past existence for current and future activity. This meaning constitutes the ground for the organization of behavior. Mythic drama, which plays out the exploits of exceptional individuals, appears devoted toward explication of a generally applicable pattern of adaptation. This archetypal model serves to aid in the generation of all situation-specific individual behaviors. Myth evolves toward declarable description of a procedural schema capable of underlying construction of all complex culturally determined hierarchies of specific behavior. This schematic pattern matches the innate, instinctual, neuropsychologically predicated individual potential for creative exploratory behavior. Indeed, has been constructed in the course of historical observation of that potential in action. The expression of this potential throughout history provides for the creation of specific, environmentally appropriate social contexts, procedural and episodic, which promote development of the innate capacities of the individual, protect from danger, offer hope, and inhibit existential fear. A ring of ancestral spirits, invisible and unknown, surrounds the modern individual and protects him or her magically from darkness and chaos. When this ring is broken, when the principles these spirits represent become subject to critical evaluation, to the onslaught of other forms of heroism, to other ideologies, or to the weight of individual experience, knowledge itself loses context, and the known reverts to the unknown. This does not mean that the terrible mother herself sleeps under human consciousness. It means rather that the reasons for her existence thousands of years ago are still sufficient reasons today. It is not a question of racial memory transmitted by Lamarckian means, but of the proclivity to experience similarly under similar conditions. These conditions arise eternally when the protective veil of culture is pierced. History protects man against overwhelming material and spiritual onslaught. It performs this function by providing a framework of meaning for those enmeshed within it. History, conceived of in this manner, comprises those a priori assumptions all cultures base themselves on, which guide the action of individuals enraptured by the spirit of the times. This framework of meaning is by necessity predicated upon various articles of faith and can be described in its totality as a myth, although it also precedes myth. The highest levels of myth provide man with the capacity to attribute meaning to or to discover meaning within the tragedy of each individual human life, forever blessed and cursed by society, forever threatened and redeemed by the unknown. To live at this mythic level, rather than to hide, means the possibility of reaching and perhaps exceeding the highest stage of consciousness yet attained or conceptualized by a particular culture. This mythic life is symbolically represented by the savior, the individual who embodies the essential aspects of the mythological drama. In the Western tradition, for better or worse, like it or not, that individual is Christ. Northrop Frye states, "The significance of the life of Jesus is often thought of as a legal significance, consisting in a life of perfect morality or total conformity to a code of right action. But if we think of his significance as prophetic rather than legal, his real significance is that of being the one figure in history whom no organized human society could possibly put up with. The society that rejected him represented all societies. Those responsible for his death were not the Romans or the Jews or whoever happened to be around at the time, but the whole of mankind down to ourselves and doubtless far beyond. It is expedient that one man die for the people," said Caiaphas, John 18:14, "and there has never been a human society that has not agreed with him." What primarily distinguishes Christianity and Judaism from most Oriental religions, it seems to me, is this revolutionary and prophetic element of confrontation with society. This element gives meaning and shape to history by presenting it with a dialectical meaning. From this point of view, the root of evil in human life cannot be adequately described as ignorance, or the cure for it correctly described as enlightenment. The record of human cruelty and folly is too hideous for anything but the sense of a corrupted will to come near a diagnosis. Hence, Jesus was not simply the compassionate Jesus, as Buddha was the compassionate Buddha. His work, though it includes teaching the ways of enlightenment, does not stop there, but goes through a martyrdom and a descent into death. Two implications here are of especial importance for our present purpose. One, a specifically historical situation is latent in any enlightenment. Man has to fight his way out of history and not simply awaken from it. Two, the ability to absorb a complete individual is, so far, beyond the capacity of any society, including those that call themselves Christian. Myth has come to encapsulate and express the essential nature of the exploratory, creative, communicative psyche, as manifested in behavior, as a consequence of observation and re-representation of that behavior in the temporally summed, historically determined manner, beginning with imitation and ending with verbal abstraction. To what end are all behaviors and representations of those behaviors archetypally subjugated? Toward establishment of a state, a spiritual kingdom, that allows the behavioral processes that transform and establish morality to flourish. Historical cultures, after all, at least those expressly open to change, organize behavior such that the self and the other are treated in the ideal, implicit or explicit, with the respect due to the mediator of order and chaos. Moral action toward other and self therefore constitutes an as-if statement from the perspective of the semantic system. The moral individual treats himself and others as if recognizing, respecting, and paying homage to the ultimate source of creative adaptation, the ultimate source of the world. Such behavior unconsciously presupposes identity between the individual and the savior, the archetypal redeemer, the culture bearer, the divine hero. This is organization of incorporated behavior in accordance with recognition of the source of incorporated behavior. Establishment of such organization, however, poses threat to morality predicated strictly upon adherence to tradition. Heroic behavior compels imitation. A hero, by definition, serves as a model for emulation. The behavior of the culture bearer, the archetypal hero, constitutes embodiment of an elaborate procedural code. This code is the end result of an evolutionary process, consisting of the establishment of creative behaviors in the course of heroic endeavor, their subsequent communication in imitation and its abstract forms, and their integration over time into a consistent pattern of behavior whose nature and expression constitutes the cultural character. This cultural character is the central personality of the healthy individual, embodied in procedure, secondarily represented in episodic and semantic memory. Ideally, this character tends toward harmonious balance between tradition and adaptation and the needs of self and other. It is the constant attempt to accurately represent such character that constitutes the aim of the stories of humanity. As history progresses, becomes more conscious and differentiated, or, more accurately, as the presuppositions underlying adaptive social behavior become more and more accurately abstractly formulated, more declarative, society moves from conceptualization of the consequences or productions of heroism as the ideal toward which behavior is to be devoted, toward conceptualization of the act of heroism itself as such an ideal. This is movement from product to process. This transformation in conceptualization is presented in dramatic form in the Western tradition in the New Testament's description of the Passion of Christ, which portrays the process and consequences of revolutionary restructuring of the axioms of Western morality. Christ has long been considered implicitly contained in the Old Testament, Northrop Frye comments. For Paul, Christ was mainly the concealed hero of the Old Testament story and the post-Easter Christ of the resurrection. The Gospels present Christ in a form that fits this pre-Gospel conception of him, not in a biographical form, but as a discontinuous sequence of appearances in which Jesus comments on the Old Testament as a series of past events, laws, and images coming permanently alive in the messianic context and body which he supplies. What this means, at the most fundamental level of analysis, is that the pattern of action, imagination, and thought that Christ represents is necessarily there in any narrative or mythology sufficiently compelling to embed itself in memory. The reasons for this implicit existence are clear in a sense. Christ embodies the hero, grounded in tradition, who is narrative depiction of the basis for successful individual and social adaptation. As the Word made flesh, John 1:14, there in the beginning, John 1:1, he represents simultaneously the power that divides order from chaos and tradition rendered spiritual, abstract, declarative, semantic. His manner of being is that which moves morality itself from rule of law to rule of spirit, which means process. Spirit is process, simultaneously opposed to and responsible for generating static being. Fry states, "We are told in the New Testament itself that the mysteries of faith have to be spiritually discerned," 1 Corinthians 2:14. This is in a passage where Paul is contrasting the letter, which he says killeth, with the spirit that giveth life. This idea is represented schematically in figure 60, the emergence of Christ from group identity and chaos, which also portrays the Christian story of man. For Christ, God is not the God of the dead, but of the living, Matthew 22:32. Christ pushes morality beyond strict reliance on codified tradition, the explicit law of Moses, not because such tradition was unnecessary, but because it was and is necessarily and eternally insufficient. He states, For I say unto you, that except your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. Matthew 5:20. But he also states, Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. Matthew 5:17. This means that identification with tradition is insufficient, that tradition cannot thereby be regarded as useless, but more in the light of a developmental precursor, and, finally, that the process that regenerates tradition is somehow implicitly contained and promoted in tradition itself. The role of Christ, who redeems culture from enslavement to the law, is prefigured at the end of Exodus, in the sequence including and continuing after the death of Moses, as discussed previously. Christ, in fact, appears as a second Moses, who offers a spiritual, intrapsychic, kingdom as the final version of the land promised to the Israelites by God. He is apparently granted the authority to make such an offer with the explicit collaboration of Moses, granted such power, like Moses, on high, as befits a solar deity. And after 6 days, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John his brother, and bringeth them up into a high mountain apart, and was transfigured before them, and his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light. And, behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elias, talking with him. Then answered Peter, and said unto Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If thou wilt, let us make here 3 tabernacles, one for thee, and one for Moses, and one for Elias. While he yet spake, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice out of the cloud, which said, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him. And when the disciples heard it, they fell on their face and were sore afraid. Matthew 17:1-9. Like Moses as well, Christ delivers his most famous address, which Northrop Frye interprets as a long commentary on the Decalogue, on a mountaintop. Frye notes that the law of Moses is based upon prohibition, description of what is forbidden, thou shalt not. By contrast, Christ's message is more in the manner of exhortation, description of active good, thou shalt. This transformation is predicated upon development of heightened moral consciousness. In the beginning, for a soul steeped in sin, so to speak, it is an easier matter to identify what is evidently morally suspect, what should obviously be brought under personal control. Once a certain clarity of spirit is attained, as a consequence of conscientious, disciplined adherence to tradition, it becomes possible to determine what the good is, what should be done, rather than merely what should not. This contrast also serves as analog to the relationship between adolescent and adult morality. Strict group identity appropriately socializes the no longer properly dependent child and allows him or her to make the leap from infancy to adulthood. The capacity to act in a disciplined manner, to follow the rules, is a necessary precondition to adult flexibility, but should not be confused with truly adult morality, which is the capacity to produce new sets of rules with updated adaptive utility. This is also not to say, idiotically, that Jewish morality is adolescent and Christian adult. Examples of prophetic antagonism to tyrannical order abound in the Old Testament, as we have seen. The contrast is rather between the dogmatic and rigid and the creative and responsible within creeds, and not between the adherents of different creeds. Development of the list of law, the moral wisdom of the past cast in stone, makes the extant procedural and episodic cultural structure explicitly conscious for the first time. The simplicity of the list makes it easily memorable and accessible as a shared point of reference. The benefits of its abstraction, communicability, and potential for rapid generalization make it a potent force for the establishment and continuation of order. The list is nonetheless characterized by the presence of profound intrinsic structural limitations. It is of insufficient complexity to truly represent the nature of procedural morality, which is hierarchically organized in a mutable and context-dependent fashion. It is unable to address suffering produced by conflict of duty, to define acceptable behavior when the situation compels conflicting behavioral response, when one listed moral prerequisite conflicts with another. The establishment of fixed law also limits capacity for judgment and choice, restricting adaptive flexibility, often dangerously, when environmental alteration makes such flexibility necessary. Beware that no one lead you astray, saying, "Lo, here," or "Lo, there," for the Son of Man is within you. Follow after him. Those who seek him will find him. Go then and preach the gospel of the kingdom. Do not lay down any rules beyond what I appointed for you, and do not give a law like the lawgiver, lest you be constrained by it. Dialogue of the Savior from the Nag Hammadi Library. As a consequence of its intrinsic limitations, the list, which states what must not be, must give way, once fulfilled, to establishment of a more abstract form of moral order, predicated upon more flexible principles, which suggests what should be. Descriptions of Christ's attempt to transcend the dangerous yet necessary limitations upon behavior imposed by adherence to the letter of the law take the form of narrative about paradox. It might be said that Christ presents, or is presented with, a series of Gordian knots, moral dilemmas, which emerge as an inevitable consequence of the structure of the list of laws. He plays a deadly serious game with the temporal representatives of then traditional order, represented in the New Testament in the form of Pharisees and scribes, teasing them into Cohen-like conundrums, which emerge as a consequence of their own beliefs. And it came to pass on the second Sabbath after the first that he went through the cornfields, and his disciples did eat, rubbing them in their hands. And certain of the Pharisees said unto them, "Why do ye that which is not lawful to do on the Sabbath days?" And Jesus, answering them, said, "Have ye not read so much as this, what David did, when himself was an hungered, and they which were with him? How he went into the house of God, and did take and eat the shew bread, and gave also to them that were with him, which it is not lawful to eat, but for the priests alone. And he said unto them, that the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath. And it came to pass also on another Sabbath, that he entered into the synagogue and taught, and there was a man whose right hand was withered. And the scribes and Pharisees watched him, whether he would heal on the Sabbath day, that they might find an accusation against him. But he knew their thoughts, and said to the man which had the withered hand, "Rise up, and stand forth in the midst." And he arose and stood forth. Then said Jesus unto them, "I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful on the Sabbath days to do good or to do evil? To save life or to destroy it?" And looking round upon them all, he said unto the man, "Stretch forth thy hand." And he did so, and his hand was restored, whole as the other. And they were filled with madness and communed one with another what they might do to Jesus. Luke 6:1-11. Similarly, and it came to pass, as he went into the house of one of the chief Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath day, that they watched him. And behold, there was a certain man before him which had the dropsy. And Jesus answering spake unto the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day?" And they held their peace. And he took him, and healed him, and let him go. And answered them, saying, Which of you shall have an ass or an ox fallen into a pit, and will not straightway pull him out on the Sabbath day? And they could not answer him these things. Luke 14:1-6. Also, and as Jesus passed by, he saw a man which was blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, Neither hath this man sinned, nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. When he had thus spoken, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay, and said unto him, Go, wash in the pool of Siloam, which is by interpretation, sent. He went his way, therefore, and washed, and came seeing. The neighbors, therefore, and they which had seen him, that he was blind, said, Is not this he that sat and begged? Some said, This is he. Others said, He is like him. But he said, I am he. Therefore they said unto him, How were thine eyes opened? He answered and said, A man that is called Jesus made clay and anointed mine eyes, and said unto me, Go to the pool of Siloam and wash. And I went and washed, and I received sight. Then said they unto him, Where is he? He said, I know not. They brought to the Pharisees him that aforetime was blind. And it was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Then again the Pharisees also asked him how he had received his sight. He said unto them, He put clay upon mine eyes, and I washed, and do see. Therefore said some of the Pharisees, This man is not of God, because he keepeth not the Sabbath day. Others said, How can a man that is a sinner do such miracles? And there was a division among them. They say unto the blind man again, What sayest thou of him that he hath opened thine eyes? He said, He is a prophet. But the Jews did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight, until they called the parents of him that had received his sight. And they asked them, saying, Is this your son, who you say was born blind? How then doth he now see? His parents answered them and said, We know that this is our son, and that he was born blind. But by what means he now seeth, we know not, or who hath opened his eyes, we know not. He is of age, ask him. He shall speak for himself. These words spake his parents, because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had agreed already that if any man did confess that he was Christ, he should be put out of the synagogue. Therefore said his parents, He is of age, ask him. Then again called they the man that was blind, and said unto him, Give God the praise. We know that this man is a sinner. He answered and said, Whether he is a sinner or no, I know not. One thing I know, that whereas I was blind, now I see. Then they said to him again, What did he to thee? How opened he thine eyes? He answered them, I have told you already, and ye did not hear. Wherefore would ye hear it again? Will ye also be his disciples? Then they reviled him and said, Thou art his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. We know that God spake unto Moses. As for this fellow, we know not from whence he is. John 9:1-29. And again. Then came together unto him the Pharisees and certain of the scribes which came from Jerusalem. And when they saw some of his disciples eat bread with defiled, that is to say, with unwashed hands, they found fault. For the Pharisees and all the Jews, except they wash their hands oft, eat not, holding the tradition of the elders. and when they come from the market, except they wash, they eat not. And many other things there be, which they have received to hold, as the washing of cups and pots, brazen vessels, and of tables. Then the Pharisees and scribes asked him, Why walk not thy disciples according to the tradition of the elders, but eat bread with unwashed hands? He answered and said unto them, Well hath Esaias prophesied of you hypocrites, as it is written, This people honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. Howbeit in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. Mark 7:5-7. Jean Piaget, in what might be considered a veritable commentary on these stories, differentiates morality of constraint from morality of cooperation, describing the former as a system of rules that affective life makes use of to control behavior. Piaget states, Since he takes rules literally and thinks of good only in terms of obedience, the child will at first evaluate acts not in accordance with the motive that has prompted them, but in terms of their exact conformity with established rules. Piaget associates morality of constraint with an earlier level of cognitive development, a level that nonetheless serves as a necessary precondition for further development. As Piaget also states, For very young children, a rule is a sacred reality because it is traditional. For the older ones, it depends upon mutual agreement. The psychologist Joseph Reichlach comments, Younger children also are much harsher in assigning punishment to those who break the rules. They seem to want to emphasize the punishment for its own sake, whereas older children use punishment more to show the transgressor that a bond has been broken between people when a wrongdoing takes place. Piaget's value system considers rule by cooperation a more satisfactory equilibration in human relations than rule by authority. In order for a rule to work without authority pressures, there must be feelings of mutual respect among the persons who subscribe to the rule. This necessarily brings affectivity into considerations of morality. Authoritarian constraint rules through feelings of anxiety and fear. But when mutual respect exists among people, a morality of cooperation can occur. Morality of tradition is not predicated upon the same presumptions as morality of cooperation. Rigid traditionalists assume that the answer to the question, what is the good, can be, has been, answered permanently and concretely with the list of laws. Such a list is always insufficient, however, for the purposes of complete adaptation. Lao Tzu can therefore say, with sufficient justification, The man who is truly wise and kind leaves nothing to be done. But he who only acts according to his nation's law leaves many things undone. Adherents of tradition rely on the attribution of superhuman value to ancestral figures and, equally, to their current temporal and spiritual representatives. Those who embrace the morality of cooperation, by contrast, value the notion of mutual respect, which means simultaneous appreciation of equality and mutual value among individuals within and, much more radically, between social groups. The behavior of any given social group, and therefore the value attributed to phenomena that constitute the shared territory of the group, emerges as a consequence of the necessity of maintaining balance between opportunity for expression of individual desire and restriction of inter-individual conflict. Such balance, vital to maintenance of group stability, is established long before the rules governing such establishment can be modeled in episodic or semantic memory from the philo and ontogenetic perspectives. Even the simplest social animals erect a dominance hierarchy and behave as if according to principle. It is an error to presuppose, however, that simpler animals can abstractly represent either their behaviors, which is to say, form an imagistic model of them in imagination, or understand the principles that govern them. Likewise, socialized children in complex human societies embody the morality of their culture in their behavior long before they are able to abstractly represent or semantically describe rationale for that morality, and before they can consciously, episodically or semantically, remember learning how to behave. The same can be said for adults. The existence of morality, that intrinsic aspect of social behavior, long precedes representation of morality and rational description of grounds for its existence. Morality, at its most fundamental level, is an emergent property of social interaction, embodied in individual behavior, implicit in the value attributed to objects and situations, grounded unconsciously in procedural knowledge. Two questions arise naturally from such a discussion. Number one, is it possible to abstract out from observation of social interaction the rules or patterns that characterize such interactions? And, if so, number two, what might those rules be? Primeval group culture determines the nature of social interaction among the members of the group and brings general expectation, predictability, to encounters between differentially desirable, powerful, and dangerous individuals in that group. The mere fact of a stable hierarchy implies the existence of a complex procedural morality and an implicit system of values. The behavior of social animals within a hierarchy constitutes de facto recognition of complex moral principles, which might be regarded as the inevitable emergent properties of constant social interaction. It is very dangerous for the entire group if any of its members engage routinely in strenuous physical competition. Exhaustion, or outright elimination, of the power of the constituent members of the group means increased risk of attack from outside. Physical competition among social animals, necessary for dominance establishment, therefore generally has a ritualistic nature and ends well before serious injury or death. Social animals have developed signals of submission, for example, which indicate their willingness to end the struggle for power. These signals are usually respected by the victor. The most powerful member of a given social group may come to dominate that group, at least in some circumstances, but the domination takes limited form. Even the most dominant of animals must act as if their expression of power is constrained by recognition of the necessity for maintenance of the group and the individuals who constitute and sustain it. This constraint, partially manifested in social affection, provides the precondition for the emergence of complex abstract morality, which originates in innate and socialized procedural knowledge, which is unconscious in essence, that is, non-representational or undeclarable. It is not too difficult to recognize in this constraint the moral imperative, treat the weak as if they too are valuable, as the Old Testament prophets insisted, or even love thy neighbor, even thy enemy, as thyself. Consider Christ's first sermon. And he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day, and stood up for to read. And there was delivered unto him the book of the prophet Esaias. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written, The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised, to preach the acceptable year of the Lord. And he closed the book, and he gave it again to the minister, and sat down. and the eyes of all of them that were in the synagogue were fastened on him. And he said unto them, This day is the scripture fulfilled in your ears. And all bare him witness and wondered at the gracious words which proceeded out of his mouth. And they said, Is this not Joseph's son? And he said unto them, Ye will surely say unto me this proverb, Physician, heal thyself. Whatsoever we have heard done in Capernaum, do also here in thy country. And he said, Verily I say unto you, no prophet is accepted in his own country. But I tell you of a truth, many widows were in Israel in the days of Elias, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, when great famine was throughout all the land. But unto none of them was Elias sent, save unto Sarepta, a city of Sidon, unto a woman that was a widow. And many lepers were in Israel in the time of Eliseus the prophet, and none of them was cleansed, saving Naaman the Syrian. And they all in the synagogue, when they heard these things, were filled with wrath, and rose up and thrust him out of the city, and led him unto the brow of the hill whereon their city was built, that they might cast him down headlong. But he, passing through the midst of them, went his way, and came down to Capernaum, a city of Galilee, and taught them on the Sabbath days. And they were astonished at his doctrine, for his word was with power. Luke 4:14-32. Also, then Jesus went hence, and departed into the coasts of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a woman of Canaan came out of the same coasts, and cried unto him, saying, Have mercy on me, O Lord, thou son of David. My daughter is grievously vexed with a devil. But he answered her not a word, and his disciples came and besought him, saying, Send her away, for she crieth after us. But he answered and said, I am not sent but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Then came she and worshipped him, saying, Lord, help me. But he answered and said, It is not meet to take the children's bread and to cast it to dogs. And she said, Truth, Lord, yet the dogs eat of the crumbs which fall from their master's table. Then Jesus answered and said unto her, O woman, great is thy faith. Be it unto thee even as thou wilt. And her daughter was made whole from that hour. Matthew 15:21-28. The kingdom of heaven, as conceived of by Christ, was not only populated by the foreigner, an inclusion sufficiently unacceptable, but by all who were deemed superfluous or sinful according to the terms of prevailing morality, by the prostitute, the tax collector, the diseased, the insane, and, most radically, by the enemy. This, of course, did not mean the end of morality, did not mean establishment of an anarchic community where everything was equal and therefore equally valueless, where the practicing and unrepentant torturer and the authentic saint would be worthy of equal distinction, but the portrayal of a state where the life of the past or the conditions of birth, no matter how wretched, did not finally determine the value of the present or the possibilities of the future. The extremely radical nature of this viewpoint profoundly disturbed the traditionalists in Christ's community. His example served as reproach to their actions, his philosophy as threat to the integrity of their most dearly held positions. In consequence, they constantly attempted to trap him into making an irrevocably criminal or heretic statement. This strategy tended to backfire badly. Then went the Pharisees and took counsel how they might entangle him in his talk. And they sent out unto him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, Master, we know that thou art true, and teachest the way of God in truth. Neither carest thou for any man, for thou regardest not the person of men. Tell us, therefore, what thinkest thou? Is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar? or not. But Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, "Why tempt me, ye hypocrites? Show me the tribute money." And they brought unto him a penny. And he saith unto them, "Whose is this image and superscription?" They say unto him, "Caesar's." Then saith he unto them, "Render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's." When they heard these words, they marveled and left him and went their way. Matthew 22:15-22. Also, and as he spake, a certain Pharisee besought him to dine with him, and he went in and sat down to meat. And when the Pharisee saw it, he marveled that he had not first washed before dinner. And the Lord said unto him, "Now do ye Pharisees make clean the outside of the cup and the platter, but your inward part is full of ravening and wickedness. Ye fools, did not he that made that which is without make that which is within also? But rather give alms of such things as ye have, and behold, all things are clean unto you. But woe unto you, Pharisees, for ye tithe mint and rue and all manner of herbs, and pass over judgment and the love of God. These ought ye to have done, and not to leave the other undone. Woe unto you, Pharisees, for ye love the uppermost seats in the synagogues and greetings in the markets. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye are as graves which appear not, and the men that walk over them are not aware of them." Then answered one of the lawyers, and said unto him, "Master, thus saying, thou reproachest us also." And he said, "Woe unto you also, ye lawyers, for ye laid men with burdens grievous to be borne, and ye yourselves touched not the burdens with one of your fingers. Woe unto you, for ye build the sepulchres of the prophets, and your fathers killed them. Truly, you bear witness that you allow the deeds of your fathers, for they indeed killed them, and ye build their sepulchres. Therefore also said the wisdom of God, 'I will send them prophets and apostles, and some of them they shall slay and persecute, that the blood of all the prophets which was shed from the foundation of the world may be required of this generation, from the blood of Abel unto the blood of Zacharias, which perished between the altar and the temple. Verily, I say unto you, it shall be required of this generation. Woe unto you, lawyers, for you have taken away the key of knowledge. Ye entered not in yourselves, and them that were entering in ye hindered.'" And as he said these things unto them, the scribes and the Pharisees began to urge him vehemently, and to provoke him to speak of many things, laying wait for him, and seeking to catch something out of his mouth, that they might accuse him. Luke 11:33-54. Christ's ability to weave his way through verbal traps continually inflamed the Pharisees, who attempted with ever more sophistry to corner him. Then one of them, which was a lawyer, asked him a question, tempting him, and saying, "Master, which is the great commandment in the law?" Jesus said unto him, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." Matthew 22:35-40. The power of Christ's unexpected answers, in conjunction with his evident mastery of traditional knowledge, Matthew 22:42-45, temporarily silenced his critics. "And no man was able to answer him a word, neither durst any man from that day forth ask him any more questions." Matthew 22:46.